Coming up on this week's show, some great news for Sega arcade fans.
How to turbocharge your Dreamcast.
We chat chiptunes and making music with C-Trix from Debug Live.
This week's show is brought to you by ExpressVPN
and our friends at Harry's.
Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 232, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And just before we started recording then, we looked at the episode number 232. Joe was like, that is a lot of episodes that we've done. And actually, I think we've kind of been reminded of that over the last week because one of our listeners, a guy called Deadlock on Twitter, tweeted us a list of every episode of the Retro Hour podcast that he's put together. We've had a lot of guests on this show, I think it's fair to say.
It's crazy because this is like in a PDF, so all of you guys can download it. You can check out the previous guests because a lot of people don't actually realize how many people we've had on. And, you know, we forget, don't we, sometimes? we'll go, oh, have we had this guy on the show? Yeah, this episode. So it's really useful to have this episode guide, and I'm hopefully going to convert it into a kind of web format as well. So we'll have just a big list on the site.
I think you made a good point then as well, because there has been occasions when I've almost been about to tweet someone to ask them on the podcast, and then, you know, go into like the Twitter DM history, and I saw that we had them on like 2 or 3 years ago. That's happened more than once, I must admit. So, yeah, cheers for doing that, Deadlock. We really appreciate that. And actually, it's today we're going to have another great addition to that as well. Now, this show, come on, Ravi, how excited are you for this week's show? All your favourite things together. We're going to be talking chip tunes, going to be talking Amigas, we're going to be talking performing with this week's special guest, one of our favourite chiptune composers, the amazing C-Trix from Debug Live.
Oh, yes, C-Trix is absolutely amazing. I remember the first time we saw C-Trix, and it was Dan shared me this video, and it was like this kind of small club in Australia. He was playing on an Amiga, and everybody was just losing it, going totally mental, jumping up and down, dancing to it, and it just looked fantastic. Well, C-Trix works with old computers making video game music, but it's not just Amigas. He works with Mega Drives. He built a thing called the Guitari, which was like an Atari 2600 kind of guitar, which is awesome. That was shared all over the Verge and Hackaday, but also he's toured worldwide. So he's gone to some fantastic festivals like Blip Festival, which no longer exists actually, in Tokyo, and just all over the world. People have been loving C-Trix, so we have a real kind of nerdy chat about making video game music.
And Ravi loves doing the interviews from Australia. What time did he have to get up to record this one?
Oh, quite early, but I had to feed the chickens anyway. And another thing C-Trix does is he does really interesting videos on video game music as well. So you might have seen some of his stuff on the channel Debug Live, where he's kind of exploring Amiga samplers and showing us how they made this music previously.
And LGR actually featured him a couple of weeks ago in a video as well, so a lot of people may have come across him since then. But, I mean, his videos are really, really well produced as well. I mean, they're put together beautifully, and he goes really in-depth into, you know, there's one on there about how music was sampled on the Amiga, and then he goes in-depth on how to use stuff like Pro Tracker and Noise Tracker. That, to me, as a kid, you know, I always kind of played around with that software, but I never had any idea what I was doing, really. So I've actually found those videos like really useful and really interesting.
Oh, yeah, they're great. And, you know, his route to making music was totally different. He was composing mods on a 486, so he wasn't even using an Amiga. A really interesting interview, this one is.
And was he a bit of an inspiration for you then? Because obviously you do, you like, you know, you're DJing on Amigas.
Oh, 100%. He was one of the first people I saw DJing with them. And, you know, I've always been like, C-Trix, send me your tunes, you know, just harassing him for years.
And C-Trix is going to be our special guest. He'll be on the show in around 15 minutes from now. Now, we've got lots of Sega news around this week that I know Joe is chomping at the bit to talk about, so we'll do that in just a minute. Before we do, let's give a big shout out to this week's supporter, our very good friends at Harry's. Now, Harry's have actually got a really interesting story behind them. Two guys, Jeff and Andy, who were fed up with overpriced razors, and they decided they were on a mission to fix shaving. And the only way that they could do that and ensure quality was by buying and setting up their own factory. Now, the idea is that they take less profit and offer you a great quality product for a fair price, and their amazing quality blades are actually almost half the price of the leading five blade brand. And recently, I know we've all been trying at Harry's, haven't we? Especially because we've all had, like, you know, a little bit too much hair. with it being in COVID lockdown over the last few months?
Yeah, I've been using Harry's, and you know, I'm probably the biggest beard owner on the Retro Hour. So I kind of need to keep that beard trimmed and, you know, keep the angles good. But the main problem I've had is, like, when you're going down, I usually shave against the grain, and I've been using Harry's, and it's kind of very smooth, and the grip's really nice as well. So I actually don't feel like I need to shave against the grain. And I know it's like the baddest thing to do, isn't it? Because you get like ingrown hairs and all of this stuff. But that was the only way I could get a really decent shave. But with Harry's, it's really nice, and the blades are especially sharp, which is great to have a smooth, really nice shave.
And Joe's dad actually told him he had to shave his beard off, so we sorted him out with some Harry's to do that.
Yeah, so I had both my dad, my wife, and my father-in-law all mention how bushy and horrible my beard was getting. So I did take the plunge a couple of weeks ago, and I mentioned it on last week's episode. And you know what? I was really pleased with the results, because usually I get, like Ravi said, really bad ingrown hairs. And I haven't actually got them this time, so I'm definitely going to be sticking with Harry's.
Well, there you go. Look at that. Harry's saving relationships and families. Now, we would like you to start shaving today by claiming your own trial set. And of course, you'll be helping out the podcast by doing this. For £3.95, that will get delivered to you, including a razor handle, the 5-blade cartridge, foaming shave gel, a travel blade cover as well. All you have to do is sign up right now at harrys.com/retro to try, thanks to our good friends at Harry's, harrys.com/retro. Now, Sega have been busy over the last couple of months. I mean, we obviously had the Game Gear Mini news. We had that Cloud Arcade gaming story that apparently was going to change the world of video games a couple of weeks ago. But actually, this announcement has kind of slid under the radar a little bit. But I actually think this is more exciting news than the Game Gear Mini for me. They're going to be doing an Astro City Arcade Cabinet Mini.
Yeah, I saw this today. Funny enough, I actually said to the guys, I was like, oh, we need to talk about this today. And Dan and Ravi were like, we already have it in the show notes, man. And I was just like, oh, wicked.
So way ahead of you there, Jeff.
Way ahead of me. So I saw this morning. I think it was announced yesterday. At the point of recording, it was yesterday. And I, like Dan says, I'm way more excited about the Sega Astro City Mini than I am the Game Gear Mini or the online service stuff they're doing. So essentially, from what I understand, the Astro City was like the iconic Japanese kind of like Sega cabinet, arcade cabinet. And it came out in like...
The one with the green buttons, isn't it?
Yeah, with the green buttons. And it came out in 93. And it's also what like the Dreamcast fighting sticks like based on as well. So it looks really cool. It's going to have 36 built-in games. They've only announced 10 so far. But what's really interesting is... for me, is Golden Axe Revenge of Death Adder is going to be on there, which is going to be the first ever official release of that game, home release of that game by Sega. You can get it on Arcade 1-Up, but this is the first time Sega have ever done that. So it's kind of like they're listening to the fans, which I think is really, really cool. But so far, they've only announced it for Japan, and it's going to be, I think it's 12,000 yen, which is about $120. So I don't know if it's going to be coming out over in the UK or not, but... what's really cool about it is you can hook it up to your TV as well. So you can play it on your TV, from what I understand. And you can put a USB controller to it as well, which I think, you know, is a lot nicer than playing on like a 4-inch screen personally.
Yeah. So looking at it, it looks quite nice. It is really small, but I was going to say the price is quite high, like $119 for it. For maybe £300 in the UK, you can get the 1-Up actual arcade cabinet that's like quite a big size, you know, not this tiny thing.
Yeah,
but I guess that's it's limited to a few games, right? That 1-Up cabinet.
Yeah, so the Arcade 1-Up, they tend to only have like 3 or 4 games on them, and obviously they look fantastic. Like I really, really, really want the Golden Axe one, and I really want the Turtles one, but I think my wife would kill me if she suddenly came home one day and there was an arcade set up in the kitchen. But I think what's, like you say, it is quite expensive at $120. So if they do come out in the UK, it would probably be about £110, £120 anyway.
Do you think they're going to be popular in Japan then? Because this Astro City, it must have been a huge kind of popular Japanese arcade thing.
Yeah,
I've not seen many of them in the UK.
When I went to Japan, I went to a lot of the arcades, the game centers as they call them, and I went to Super Potato as well, and they had them up in the on the third floor. And literally, like, that was like the main arcade cabinet you saw everywhere. Like they were just everywhere, those white, the white ones with the green stripes.
And I think there's a lot of that about wanting the Sega arcade games at home as well. I mean, like you said then, I remember playing Golden Axe Revenge of Death Adder, and I was always convinced it was going to come out, you know, if not on the Mega Drive, it'd come out on the Saturn or something like that. And obviously it never did.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, if they're going to be kind of putting these games that you could only experience in the arcade on these home machines. I mean, you mentioned then that you could hook it up to a TV with HDMI and you can probably plug in like an Xbox controller. That kind of defeats the object a little bit.
I guess it's just an official way of playing it at home. But like the video I was watching this morning was saying that Virtua Fighter's going to be on it. And that's the first it's going to be the first ever arcade perfect port of it.
It'd be quite funny if you had a MAME cabinet and then you went up and you put this mini arcade on it and then plugged it in and it was like, that's the one that I'm playing at the moment. You know, it would be quite nice.
Arcade Inception.
Yeah, that would be quite funny.
You know what? I do like the look of it. And again, I think, you know, these Astro City machines, they are iconic. And I think for a lot of people who wanted one at home, I mean, I imagine they're probably getting harder to find, especially the originals with the, I think they've got like a 19-inch CRT in there as well.
Yeah.
One thing I do like, though, is unlike the Game Gear Mini, this does actually look like it's big enough to be usable.
Yeah, this is 7 inches with a 4.8-inch screen, I think, or 3.8-inch screen, something like that. So kind of like your phone kind of size screen. But yeah, it does actually look a little bit more playable, but then really similar to the Neo Geo Arcade Mini that came out a year or two ago. And I know a few people had issues with them and just said it was better just to play them on the big screen. So we'll see, I guess.
One thing I like, one little nice bit of attention to detail, is even though obviously it's like an LCD screen in there, they've actually curved the glass a little bit by the looks of it. So it kind of imitates a curved CRT.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. So the little things that we love Sega for, isn't it? But I think, you know, this news should have been bigger. It's way more exciting than, you know, the cloud gaming thing they announced a couple of years ago.
Yeah, which was as big as the PS5.
Keep it coming, Sega. Keep surprising us. Now, actually, speaking of systems that you might want to choose over your PS5, it's now been announced. It is coming out on November 27th, in time for the holidays this year, the Atari VCS release date. And we have pricing information as well. Now, obviously, this has been a story that we've covered since that original trailer came out back in 2018. And it's a project that's kind of been, you know, fraught with a lot of problems. There's been a lot of things have done wrong. But, I mean, the good news is the hardware is real. We've now got a release date. Apparently it's getting manufactured now. We're expecting that if you want to go out and get a new Atari VCS PC-based console, you're going to be able to pick one up in time for Christmas this year. But, I mean, looking at the pricing of it, apparently for, like, the top-end one, you could be talking nearly $400 for it.
Ouch.
Which actually, their timing was pretty rubbish on this because they announced that if you're going to get it with the classic joystick, modern controller, the 8GB version with 32GB of storage, it sets you back $390. But also the rumour is that that is going to be the same price that the Xbox One Series S and the PlayStation 5 are going to retail for. So there's a bit of competition there.
Yeah, and the fact that, like, I mean, I'm not a technical guy. And when you just look at a console, like something modern coming out and you're like, oh, it's got a 32 gig hard drive, when like the PlayStation 5 is having like an 850 gig one and the Xbox Series X is like having a terabyte, you're just like, it's just going to kind of fall into that obscurity and only super fans are going to buy it. Let's be honest. Like, that's how I feel about it. You know, it's going to be one collecting dust at Dan's house. Like.
You know, when you see like some outdated system or some system that does technical specifications and they put like mouse and keyboard support. Yes. It's like, of course it has mouse and keyboard support. That's not one thing you should be putting in the specifications. Like, it's great that we support mouse and keyboard. That's kind of a thing that you do when you're releasing like an Amiga product or something that's not really going to be huge. I find it quite odd. There are some nice things. Like, they've made the RAM replaceable. That's good that it's not a set version of RAM, but there's a lot of things in here that they're shouting about, like cross-game chat, Skype, Discord. Like, you can run Discord.
It's
great.
It's like, you know, when you used to get like a cheap shovelware Xbox 360 game and back like 10 years ago, and you'd look at like the things on the back and it would say, yes, achievements.
Like
every other game.
just makes me think they haven't got much to talk about if they're playing mouse and keyboard support. Yes.
Oh, God. LED light up on and off button.
Second screen, screencasting. Yes. Like, everything does screencasting. My phone does screencasting.
Well, you know, interestingly, I mean, a lot of people have kind of been saying that, you know, your phone is more powerful than this product. If you've got, like, you know, a recent iPhone, for example. Yeah. I mean, I haven't seen any, like, benchmarks of this system yet, but based on the AMD Ryzen system on a chip that's in there, some people have kind of been putting it on maybe, like, Xbox 360 kind of performance.
Okay.
So, I mean, if you're comparing that price-wise to a PS5, you're talking something that's two generations older in terms of performance that's going to be retailing for the same price. I mean, I imagine if you want to buy an Atari VCS, you're probably a different market to someone who's going to buy a PS5. But yeah. I think, you know, even though this is essentially, we've talked about it before, it is a PC in a fancy case. And not even a really high-end PC, a pretty average spec PC.
Linux machine as well, really.
Yeah. With like a custom skin and some,
and like they're just saying stuff like built-in web browser. Like, come on, guys, it's 2020.
Yeah,
that should.
I mean, I love the look of it.
Like listed as a feature.
I mean, I love the look of it and the case and everything. The design I do like, and I mean, for like, you know, £90, maybe I'd pick one up as like a nice media center or something. But when you're asking like $400 for it, I think I don't know. I'm looking at this and thinking they're going to struggle now.
I like voice commands with a forefront facing mic array. Like, why have you not just made it so it reacts with Alexa or one of those kind of things, rather than have a full mic array that kind of picks up your voice and all this custom stuff? It seems like they're just chucking features at it.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a tough sell. I mean, a lot of people have kind of been saying it's, you know, Atari have made the Ouya 2, but the Ouya only costs £99.
That was a bit of an impulse buy.
I
wasn't expecting this to be like £390 or whatever it is. Like, I wasn't expecting that at all, you know, to play some old Atari games for an hour.
You know, if I kind of makes separate, me think that, you'll make more money, I think.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, we were talking the other week about that Raspberry Pi kit that you can get. You know, if you get the high-end Raspberry Pi 4, chances are that'll probably be higher performance than this anyway.
Yeah.
And you can put it in like a cute little Atari case. And, you know, all the ROMs, like, you fit in an SD card. So you can probably do the same thing for about £100 at most. So I think, you know, apart from selling that custom case, there's not really a lot here that's going to entice. I mean, I'm struggling to find the audience for it. I mean, even retro gamers,
the killer app or the killer game, you know, if there's we're going to have, you know, Jeff Minter's latest title exclusive or something like that, that may be a bit of a draw, but I can't see any of that at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we'll find out what their plan is when it comes out. We've now got the release date, November 27th. Of course, we'll keep an eye on that. And if you want to find out more, I'll link that up in our show notes and everything else we talk about this week at theretrohour.com. Now, Worms is obviously one of the best two-player games, or multiplayer games of all time, actually. And it was actually quite good timing with everyone being in lockdown that you might want to have an online two-player game with your mates. They've announced a new Worms game is coming out, and this is called Worms Rumble. Now, Worms has always been a franchise that has been a little bit hit and miss for me. I love the original games, and, you know, Worms Deluxe is one of my all-time favourite Amiga games. And then I didn't mind some of the later ones, but when it kind of went into that, the 3D kind of gameplay, I wasn't a big fan. But actually, some of the recent ones have been all right again. And this one, of course, now, obviously, everything's copying off Fortnite. This is going to feature Battle Royale mode in there, too. But they've actually gone back to kind of the 2D kind of look.
I'm going to sound like a right miserable guy on this week's episode. But I love the Worms titles. And they did go awry and kind of, there were ones where you had to collect tokens and stuff to get stuff. And I really wasn't into that. But Worms WMD was a bit of a return to form, but this Worms Rumble seems to kind of take the element of Worms that I enjoy most out of the game. They might have done it fantastically, but they're ditching the kind of turn-based gameplay.
That's what I wanted to say. It's real time, isn't it? Like, so it reminds me of, I mean, I've not seen any screenshots of anything like that, so I'm glad to hear that it's still that 2D look, but it reminds me of, you know, Plants vs. Zombies, when they went from their like original kind of like what the game was to like a 3D kind of like third person game. So I was worried it was going to be something like that, but I didn't even think that it was going down that vein of like Fortnite and like Warzone.
Well, there is a trailer video that I'll link up that you can check out as well. They're actually showing real-time combat with 32 player teams. So, I mean, it does kind of look like the camera's moving all over the place and there's like, you know, there's action going on in every corner of the screen. So it looks a bit like, you know, a bit like mayhem on screen, I guess, but The one thing I think is, you know, I guess they've got to think of something new. They can't just keep making the same Worms games that they made 25 years ago every year.
Yeah, I think for me, it's what makes Worms unique, that competitive kind of vibe. When you see someone and they're about to do something amazing and they completely mess it up and all the other players are just laughing, or, you know, somebody does something really cool and it's that kind of seeing it, but also it's a very kind of slow-paced game on that. So maybe this will improve it. But to be honest, I thought that was one of the best moments of Worms. And like previously, they've had Worms WMD and they've added tanks and stuff like that and vehicles, but it's not really that innovative. You know, like it would be cool to see, I've always dreamed of a music festival where everyone can log on their phone and play like 10,000 people on a match of Worms.
Well, all music festivals are virtual. That could happen, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, another product that's had a release date announced as well over the last week. Now, this is something else that we've talked about for a while. The Poly Mega is apparently going to be out in November at the latest, or maybe even a little bit earlier if they can get them manufactured in time. Now, this is a system. I mean, we'll do a little recap for people that might not remember the story when I think we talked about it about, what, 2 years ago now? This essentially aims to be the only retro gaming console that you'll ever need. And it supports stuff like NES, SNES games, Mega Drive, Neo Geo CD, the Sony PlayStation. If I remember, there's a bunch more in there as well. And it really means that you only need one box that will connect up to your modern TV, one set of controllers, and you can play all your retro games, your original games, on this device.
I saw that there was a preview version of this, which was on MVG's channel. And it looked like quite a nice device, actually. You have to buy separate units for the different systems. So they're going to slowly release all of them throughout time. But you can play a lot of the original carts in it. And it's kind of like this stack system. I like the concept. Let's see how well it works.
Well, apparently they were trying to get it out earlier. But obviously, like everything else, there's been manufacturing issues with their COVID and factories closing down around the world. They reckon that apparently they're aiming for November 15th as a release date now as well. But what is interesting is it didn't originally support Famicom carts. And someone tweeted them asking for that and they said there'll be news on that soon. So I think, like you said, the fact that it's like a modular system, I guess if they get enough demand, they can probably just release editions for any systems that people demand, I guess.
Yeah, and then tweak them, update the firmware and stuff. But the kind of videos that have come out already about the Poly Mega are pretty positive, and it looks like quite a cool system for those people that really want to have a nice, you know, HD output and be able to play the original stuff in there as well.
Now, it is cool, and I think especially for people, like you said, you know, that want to play their original games and cartridges, there is something sometimes a bit more satisfying about plugging a cartridge in rather than just, you know, picking something from a big list of downloaded games, I think.
I think Joe probably doesn't remember it because it changed names a couple of times.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, I'm looking at this and I'm just like, I don't recognize this at all. Like, we've been talking
it was always a modular system, but I remember they had original name and then it changed. And then changed a few designs and stuff.
Yeah. And to be fair, there is, like, you know, modern retro systems that we seem to talk about every week, but yeah. I think out of all of them, this one does look pretty cool.
I mean, this one's just caught my eye looking at it now because it's got the Neo Geo CD drive on it. Like, that's the only reason it's caught my eye. And I was like, oh, I should pay attention to this.
Joe's writing his list to Santa right now as we
speak. I am.
Now, before we chat to Ctrix, our special guest this week, let's talk about the Dreamcast. I mean, you know, we always talk about the Dreamcast on this show. It's one of our favourite systems collectively, a system that we always think deserved a bit more love than it got back in the day. But quite thankfully, it's actually, you know, gets a lot of respect from the retro gaming community today. But maybe you look at your Dreamcast and think, I'd like to give that a bit more power. I'd like to soup up my Dreamcast. Well, actually, now there's a guide that's been printed that you can actually follow if you want to upgrade your Dreamcast RAM from 16 megabytes to 32 megabytes. So you might be looking at this and thinking, well, what reason have I got for wanting to double the RAM in my Dreamcast? Obviously, it's going to mean that stuff like Homebrew and emulators can take advantage of that extra memory in there. And I know, Ravi, in particular, you're always up for, like, you know, modding systems and stuff like that. This opens a few doors, I think, to things that maybe weren't possible previously on the Dreamcast.
Yeah, so this looks really interesting. Actually, it's quite easy to do if you're a bit of a solderer. It's basically diverting these pins so that more SD RAMs addressed. it seems cool. It's not actually supported in any games because I don't think they made any games to support 32 mega RAM, but it seems to be supported for homebrew and emulators, which is pretty cool.
And there's an article here on retrorgb.com, and they're talking about the fact that this could maybe lead to Naomi ROMs being supported on the Dreamcast as well, because now there'll be enough memory to fit them in.
Oh, cool. That would be really good. Yeah. What was Naomi? It was the arcade version, wasn't it, before the Dreamcast?
Yeah, it was the arcade version, essentially, wasn't it?
Yeah, so you can end up getting some arcade ROMs on your kind of original Dreamcast hardware. That would be pretty good.
That is pretty cool. I was literally just like reading through the article, and I was thinking to myself, like, most homebrew games I kind of see for the Dreamcast are usually just like really souped up 2D fighters or 2D beat 'em ups. But I guess if it's opening up that, so you could play like the kind of like, you know, like the original Soul Calibur, how, you know, the arcade version of it and stuff, that'd be really cool.
And the Dreamcast has always been a system that you can do quite a lot with. I mean, the homebrew scene's massive on it, isn't it? And obviously there's like, you know, different emulators and things you can get for it. And I think the fact that it was opened up so early means that it's had like, you know, 20 years of kind of independent development on it. So, and the scene's still really active today. I mean, what was that we were reading? I think like the year before last, I think in 2018, there was more Dreamcast homebrew releases that year than actual games had come out since 2001. So it's like, you know, the scene's still really active. And I think if, you know, they're going to be releasing emulation and ports and stuff that will take advantage of having double the RAM in there, you know, it could really knock our socks off, actually, the kind of things it can do with that.
I even saw a video this week by Adam Karelic about a new Dreamcast game that had come out. So, yeah.
Adam's always a go-to man, isn't he, if you want to find out what's happening in the world of Dreamcast.
He's the dude.
So before we get into our chat with Ctrix, let's just give a big thank you to this week's supporter, our very good friends at ExpressVPN. Now, maybe you're working from home at the moment, or maybe you're back in the office and a lot of people around the world have started going back into work. There might be things that you want to do on the internet that you don't want other people to know about. Now, there's various reasons that you might want to improve your privacy online. Maybe you've got like a business plan that you're working on, you want to keep to yourself. Well, you might be thinking, why don't I just use incognito mode on my browser? The thing about it is, a lot of people think incognito mode means that you're private. It doesn't actually hide your activity, because your internet service provider can actually still see everything that you're doing. And there have been stories about ISPs around the world that can actually legally sell your information to advertising companies. I know something's all, that's always bugged you, hasn't it, Ravi, that they can do that?
Yeah, and also, like, if you're joining an unsecure network, so if you're joining a network like a hotel or a coffee shop, then people can actually sniff your packets and see what you're actually doing. And if you've got sensitive information, if you're doing financial transactions, or you're kind of, you've got work on there that you don't want other people to see, then 100% you need to VPN up and kind of get yourself protected. So what I do is, on my laptop, I have ExpressVPN. So whichever network I connect to, straight away, it automatically starts up, minimizes, and then I just don't need to worry about other people in the area. You know, you could even have the guy that you're sitting across the room drinking coffee from kind of sniffing all your information. It's really insecure, actually, some of these networks.
So having ExpressVPN on there, that's an app that reroutes your internet connection through their ultra-secure servers, and even your internet provider can't see what sites you're visiting. It keeps all of your information secure by encrypting 100% of your data with the most powerful encryption available. And like you said, I mean, most of the time, you don't even realize that you've got ExpressVPN on. It runs seamlessly in the background, really simple to use. Tap one button and you're protected. And you can run it on all your devices as well. You know, if you're on your phone, your laptop, your computer, your smart TV, there's no excuse not to be using it. So all you have to do, if you want to try out ExpressVPN on us, get 3 months free on a one-year package. And of course, you'll be helping out the podcast by doing it. Visit this website address right now, expressvpn.com/retro. That's expressvpn.com/retro. Thanks to our good friends at ExpressVPN. Yeah, you don't want strangers sniffing your packets.
No.
We don't want that. Right then, now, before we get into our interview, let's just give a big thank you to our very special donators. Now, of course, we do have a Patreon running at the moment. You made a really good point, actually, last week, Ravi, that the reason we have a Patreon is because we want to reinvest every penny that we make through that back into the podcast.
Yeah, totally. So a lot of people have patrons and they just usually use it as income. And, you know, with that, we're offering fantastic perks like ad-free episodes and, you know, exclusive content, and there's different tiers on there. But what we want to do is actually take this patron money and build a studio, have a physical space, and we're not going to build it from bricks and mortar. We just mean that we're going to actually get in a space. Dan's got quite a lot of the equipment already, which is fantastic. So this money's kind of going to go to renting a space and being able to help us produce more content. So, you know, we can put out other podcasts, we can do some video work from there, and also we can help really improve the quality, because at the moment our studio space, we can't get in there because of COVID at the moment. But also, if we're doing recordings like from Australia, like this week's episode in the morning, then we'll be able to come into the studio and do that. So, you know, it's really going to help out the podcast and ensure it has a good future.
Yeah, because I've been doing the show from home. I mean, I'm in the studio on my own at the moment, because if I did the show from home, I'd have my puppy barking in the background.
He's got a new dog, yes.
But we often have to stop recording because Ravi's cat wanders in the background, or Joe's missus might shout him because he hasn't took the bins out or something. So it is going to be nice if we can all get back together in our own studio, like you said, dedicated Retro House studio, and we can get guests in from all around the world. People can come in. I mean, if you're ever in Nottingham, come visit us, hang out. We'll have a space where we can do the show from.
And of course, even be able to do video.
Yeah, I mean, it's an investment in the future of this show, really. So every penny that we earn through Patreon, we guarantee is going to go back into the future of this podcast. And of course, for making a donation into there and supporting us, you will get a shout in a future episode in the Retro Hour Hall of Fame. Like this week, thank you very much to Mike Thorpe,
Steve Engledow,
Henrik Lagford,
Stephen Quinn,
and Julian Shepherd,
who all made donations into our Patreon. Really appreciate that, guys. And of course, we've got another Patrons Hangout coming up very soon as well. Probably next weekend, I imagine, Sunday night. So we'll put all the details to that on our Patrons page as well, if you want to join us on there. Always a bit of a giggle on a Sunday night. We all get together, chat about retro games. Any questions you got? You know, just a really good bunch of guys. We get together, just proper nerd out about retro things. So you'll find all the information for that and everything else on our website at theretrohour.com. Right, we'll have more news for you on next week's show. And coming up in a minute, then, we are going to be joined by Ctrix from Debug Live, talking about chiptunes, making them, performing live. He'll be our special guest on the Retro Hour podcast next.
You're listening to the Retro Hour, and I'm here with Ctrix. How you doing, mate?
I'm very well, thanks, mate. How are you?
Awesome, awesome. Well, we always kind of start our interviews with, you know, what was your first computer or what was your first gaming experience? But I'm thinking, because this is a sound interview, we'll go on to what was the first computer sound you heard or the first tune that really got you hooked?
Well, I guess I sort of grew up with listening to music in the car, as I think a lot of kids did with their, you know, their parents just playing stuff. And I was quite lucky my folks would get those Now compilation tapes, which is a very UK thing. For anybody internationally who's never heard of them, they're like, you get these tape, we used to in the 80s, these tapes that were like a compilation of all the sort of, you know, top 40 stuff. But they were quite good in including, you know, some of the electronic stuff and hearing groups like Propaganda and Pet Shop Boys and things like that. And that was the stuff I liked listening to. So I was like, oh, we need more of this. And so my folks would sort of go out and find some stuff along those lines to listen to. And, you know, I was maybe three or four. And that was like, you know, that was my thing. That was my jam. So at about the same time, we got a C64. So, I mean, I was really just like, you know, I would just like have the game and then I'd just wait on the screen, you know, and listen to the music because I was like, this tune's really good. So it was really a combination of what was happening, I guess, in the UK with that that UK sort of pop electronic sound and yeah, also just having a Commodore 64 and vibing out on all of those amazing tunes, you know.
Because you get that kind of Stock Aitken and Waterman sound on the Now That's What I Call Music, but you'd also get the occasional rave or dance track chucked in there as well.
And that was the stuff that was like, there's that track on there. It's like, what is that? So as a very young, and there was, unfortunately, we didn't get the best radio receptions in the world, but there was a couple of radio stations you could tune into and they're a bit fuzzy, but you'd also get, you know, the more house sound or something. But, you know, I had a really crappy little radio clock by my bedside table. You know, it was the first thing, real thing I ever got for my birthday. I was like, I want a radio clock. You know, that was a thing in the 80s to have a radio clock, you know. So, and that allowed me to tune in and just listen at night. But, oh, you know, just super fuzzy background. I was just yearning for it. But it wasn't until I was maybe 8 or 9 that I really got, you know, the Technotronic and, you know, Pump Up the Jam sort of stuff. And that was when I was like, right, this is this is good.
Yeah, I remember first time I heard Prodigy Experience on a tape. I was just like, what is this? You know, it was great. What kind of stuff were you doing on your dad's C64 then?
Oh, we had a program. It was a very early musical program called, I think it was just C64 Composer. And it was hellish to use. I'm going to do a video on it soon just to revisit how I like did anything and used the joystick. It was the kind of program that would have advocated a mouse, but you used a joystick instead, you know, to draw notes on a staff. But it had this mode you flipped into that had all of the ADSR and the bandpass filters and all that. And you could tweak around with that and make all of these wild sounds. And I guess I spent a lot of my time just playing with that screen. I'd put a few random notes in. I didn't really care so much what they were, but I just, you know, would play with the settings screen just to try to figure out what all of these weird shapes and what's the square one versus the weird, you know, mountain one. What did they all, why did they all sound different? And, you know, I hit this rezo button and it did something else really weird. And I had no idea what I was doing, but I just knew I liked to play.
So that was totally pre-tracker as well. It was pre-tracker, kind of different interface.
That would have been 1985, 86. So pretty early. Yeah, probably 86, actually. Pretty early in the C64. You know, me having one and been able to twiddle with it. I don't even know how we got the software, but Dad from work somehow got it. I mean, my folks knew I was into music because I was playing piano from a very young age. So, you know, it was sort of obvious, oh, we got a computer. Well, let's get something that says music in the title.
Well, were you kind of exposed to the demo scene at the time? And did you wonder, like, what are these flashy things on the screen?
Oh, the crack stuff. Yeah. I mean, we didn't have that much. I had a few crack throws on stuff and it was pretty cool. I do remember like stopping and listening to the tracks and a couple of really cool loaders as well. But I guess, you know, you like it was cool and it sort of went in passing, but I didn't dwell on it at the time. It was a bit later that I got into the tracking and the sort of demo scene stuff. Because the other thing is we didn't have a modem or anything. People forget that to have a BBS access was super expensive. So
yeah, it was only kind of the discs that your friends would have and the kind of stuff that you'd see. You know, it would keep that culture a bit limited until you actually had somebody who had access to a BBS or was online.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it was when we had a family friend who had access that we used to go around for dinner and I'd just be like, you know, grab the guy and I'd be like, come on, I need all your stuff that's to do with mod file and to do with the demo scene. And yeah, that was second reality really when I hit that, but that was well into tracking. So early on, like, you know, I was very much that C64 inspiration, but not really knowing what I was doing so much, which is an interesting way to approach it. But I was also starting to program BASIC and wanting to do this when I was like maybe six, and wanting to do sound and stuff. And there was just these really confusing poke commands that I didn't really know what was happening either, but I knew that I could copy. Used to get magazines, like these Mad magazines, that would have like you put a coding list in and it would give you part of a computer game, or, you know, you would get these little how to program books, and I would just flip straight to the sound part and just try to figure out the lines that would make the sound. So I'd have these fragments of poke commands, not having no idea of memory mapping or anything like of the complex stuff, and just be manging around trying to make the Commodore 64 make any old sound, like, you know, for hours. It was just like, make a sound, come on.
Well, what point did you actually get a machine and then start composing on your own?
That would have been, I suppose, a bit later on. We always had I was quite lucky. We had this Technics grant. It was like a electric piano kind of thing, but it had a four-part recorder on it, so you could actually record and then save your track on a floppy disk. So for years, that was really how I composed. I was just composing on the hardware on that, but it didn't have a step sequencer or anything, and you could never get anything tight. It was always like as you played it, and it wasn't, even as a kid, like I was listening to, you know, the Technotronic and the Pop Up the Jam and stuff, and just like, you know, oh, I want to get that sort of like big chunky sound, and there's just all these preset like clavitones and stuff. It just wasn't really making the sound I wanted. And I was like, how do I get that sound? And that was when I came across, it was, I saw an Amiga, actually. I remember donkeys years ago, I saw one, the Commodore Expo, like when I was a kid, and I remember seeing that and going, wow. But then 3 or 4 years later, I was at a friend's house, and yeah, his dad had an Amiga, and I heard that and I was like, right, what is that? How is that working? And they showed me it was like an early primitive tracker. And I remember hammering a few notes into that and going, right, I need to find this. But not having an Amiga at the time, it was really like, I need to find this for PC. And there was a really terrible piece of software called ModEdit that worked through the PC speaker. And even though I had an early Sound Blaster, didn't actually come through the Sound Blaster. So I ended up hooking my PC speaker into like a external amplifier. And it was like always a bit of contention. Like my dad, like, what are you doing?
But wow, that must have been really loud as well. If you had an external amp, the PC.
Yeah. Well, you turn it down, yeah, because it was 5 volts. So it was bad, and it would distort a bit. But when I played it back, I had playback software for mods for playing them back through the Sound Blasters. It was just when I was composing them, they sounded like really crunchy, and there was these high speed squeals and stuff, or high like pitch squeals in the background. And then after learning that for a while, so it was a program called ModEdit. It was very early, but it was all I could get because, you know, I just went to my local shareware store and they just had this thing called ModEdit. And I was like, well, that's got to be a mod editor. Like the guys at the store didn't know what it was. You know, yeah, you used to have shareware stores with just floppy disks everywhere, and you just like flip through them with your $2 pocket money, you know, £1 pocket money, trying to find the floppy that had the software that you needed, you know.
I had exactly the same experience. We had a kind of a piracy store, I'd say, and I'd be sitting on my knees flipping through all the discs trying to find something decent to use.
Yeah, it's funny. People don't realize, like before, if you didn't have access to that whole BBS scene, which was really only a very small part of the population, the majority of people did go hard, like, you know, floppy disks.
So you were actually making mods on the 486 then. What was it like when you put Amiga?
On the SX25. Well, I had a friend who had the Amiga too, so I would go around and his place and actually like have a twiddle and play, you know, for an hour or so here and there. And I eventually managed to borrow their old 500 for a little bit of time as well. And
oh, nice.
So I did sort of have semi access to Amiga here and there. And the thing was just like, it was night and day on the Amiga. I mean, it just sounded so much better. And I didn't know for years why until later on when I got one and I did some research, but you know, it was like very obvious that the Amiga had something more going on under the hood. And of course it was actually just the Amiga was how it was supposed to sound. And the Sound Blaster was always truncating it back to 8-bit and stuff. Like, you know, it was doing a very crude playback, but I didn't know that for a long time. Well, I did, but I didn't understand why till much later.
It's weird when you look back on it, isn't it? Because when I was younger, I thought, you know, oh, the CRT monitors, the graphics look absolutely amazing and the sound looks amazing. And I think, was that kind of rose-tinted glasses when I was a kid? But now you actually go back to these machines and they sound so clear and really, really amazing, actually.
Yeah, well, this was the thing. And I guess this is with chip music, what a lot of people have realized. I mean, you take something like, I mean, the classic is the Atari 2600. The 1976 Pong machine, basically, but with a little bit more functionality. You know, it's got a few sprite fields and it's got 128 bytes of memory. Like that's not much. And, you know, but yet you get the sound chip on that and then you chuck it through a big PA system and it's huge and it's clean and it's like, wow. I remember the first time I modded Atari 2600 and then I powered it on in the studio and it went bang when I turned it on. I was like, oh, fuck. And then I was like, turning up the volume, I couldn't hear anything. I was like, there's no hiss on this. And then I pressed play and it just like, the loudest, like, hugest sound. I was like, wow. It's probably one of the highest quality devices I have in terms of silent noise floor and just super full range sound, you know.
And it's that kind of weird analog digital kind of crossover with it. It's sounding like you've plugged a synth in or something.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And if I fire up a track right now from the Atari. You know, it's just that it's so digital, but it's so like it is, like you say, a synth. It's that experience of definitely hearing something that's big, you know.
And it's got that range as well.
Yeah.
Which I think other things don't have anymore because, you know, I've seen people DJing or playing on other systems and it's kind of all in the mid and it hasn't got the real highs or the real nasty lows.
Well, it sort of depends how you, I guess, sort of mix and master things. But I guess with these machines, like, I mean, if you look at how the Atari makes it sound, it's a very, it's kind of squarish in the way it sort of turns stuff on and off very quickly and does like sort of rapid pulses of stuff. But it's always going to have that because it's kind of, it does volume up and down as well. It does actually draw some pretty incredible waveforms, but it just makes such a sharp sound when it, but it's slightly angled because of the speed of the silicon. And that's funny because you're starting to hear that it's still in the era where you hear the physical limitations a little bit of what the thing can do, like on a voltage level. So it's just, there's so many reasons why these old machines have just got character that you don't find. It's nuance. It's very subtle nuances. But, you know,
you miss that. Yeah, I find even with like modern music at the moment, people will be trying to produce like 80s synthy stuff and they'll be producing it on a new piece of equipment and it just won't sound the same as the kind of original kind of sound.
Well, and a lot of it is it gets slightly overproduced, and I've found this a little bit. I did buy Omnisphere, which is like a fairly big collection of stuff, and it's got some great stuff, but everything is very oversampled and very like pure and like big. But when you like have it all together being digitally mixed from multiple instances, it just kind of layers in a very like every time it triggers or plays, it's the same kind of phase or the same. Like, it's hard to describe, but it doesn't sound the same as getting like a Prophet, a DX and a drum machine and putting it through a mixer and taking the line out. And that sounds softer and less punchy, doesn't have that same, you know, modern big production values, but it has a sound about it that's different. It's very different. So, and a lot of that is to do with the way things mix and things engineer together. So I guess, you know, and there's so much effort to try to simulate all of that on modern computers, yet everybody just, I think, pushes it and overproduces, like, you know, because they want it to sound big on a sound system. But, you know, you've got your sound engineer for that who's, you know, should be tweaking that.
Well, when you started to get into the demo scene, like, were there any musicians that you were looking up to? Were there any really standout demos or intros that the music just kind of blew your mind?
The first thing on the Amiga that I came across, and also on the PC, because it was a PC port, was Pinball Dreams. Was one of the first mods where I was like, right, well, this is incredible. And the introduction sequence, which turned out to be Blazer from TPL, the Black Lotus. I'm actually wearing the T-shirt, right, TBL T-shirt today. You know, they had these crossovers to the demo scene. And so that was where I was like, and I started looking inside the mod files, ripping the mod files from Amiga game. So I'd actually go to my mate's place who had an Amiga, and I would use ripping utilities to rip out mods and to grab just the music. And then I would go home and listen to the music and, you know, and pull it apart and check it out. And yeah, and there was also Lemon was another artist, and there was Fleshbrain was another artist, and there was a bunch of them. Skaven now, was Skaven or was it Purple Motion? Or was a couple of them did a couple of mods as well. So there was that on the Amiga. There was a bunch of other kind of artists I'd come across as well, and the RSI guys and things. And then, yeah, on the PC, there was obviously the people like Future Crew and Jurassic, what were they called? A bunch of the early guys anyway, where I had probably five or six key demos, which I managed to source. And that was hugely inspirational, just to, watch to have this visual element with it, but also just to listen to these really cool trancey tunes, which luckily that was the point where I was able to start listening to later and later at night and discover, oh, okay, so this is where all the good music happens on the radio. And that's, you know, where I started getting into the electronic stuff. So, but it was actually, I heard it from Trackers first. I would have been probably about 11. Oh, no, it would have been less than that. It would have been probably 9 or 10 first. And I would have heard it from Trackers first before I then discovered community radio and late night DJ shows.
You're right about the mods as well, because being able to rip the samples from there and kind of take them apart was really important. And you can't do that with many other formats unless you find a clean drum in there, or you find a section where no other instruments are being played.
Well, that was a huge thing, yeah. And there's a sort of bit of a standard joke, I guess, that some of my early tracks like had sounded like something straight out of Pinball Dreams. It's because I was using those samples. That were the samples I had. And that thing of being able to share, and that was like early on, it really taught me the massive beneficial side of open source, you know. And I mean, not that it was open source, it was public domain. And you know, people did say, well, you knew you weren't just going to copy someone's track straight out. But to be able to take those instruments, suddenly, you know, you get yourself a nice little house track from, you know, Euphoria or one of those crews. And then, you know, you've got a kick drum and you've got a beat, and then you've got like, you know, some vocal stabs and some, you know, stuff that's been sampled from, you know, Inner City or whatever. And yeah, suddenly it's like, oh, I've got these sounds. And then that mixed with the stuff you've taped off the radio, where you know, you'd get a recording of a cold cut track or something, and you'd just be like playing in and isolating the instruments and things like that. It was a really nice combo of your own stuff and other people's, you know, instruments from their tracks. And you knew if you put something out, you were sort of, it was almost like a badge of honor if somebody took your sound. So,
well, were you aware of a Aussie demo scene at all? Or did you think all these tunes were kind of coming from Europe or America?
Yeah, well, I knew they were sort of, because people are pretty proud about where their music's from. And I used to get, it was really hard to, because I lived in a smaller country town in Australia. So it was, you know, about a pound a minute, or, you know, $1.50 US a minute to, you know, to have a BBS like access. So you just didn't really dial into other places. You couldn't, like, it was just too expensive. So I would get stuff through very early on. I was very lucky. We got a CD-ROM drive, like a single speed one, on the very first iteration of like multimedia, because my folks knew I was so into it. And I was able to pick up some early multimedia discs that were just full of, in inverted commas, public domain stuff. And it was like people just getting absolutely everything they could and shoving it on a CD. But there was one particular one in Australia that had managed to track down. They were obviously a demo scene nut. And to this day, I'm still trying to meet the person that did it, because I've heard of them, and just thank them, because they got things like chat logs from all the BBS boards of all the BBS part of like bunches of demo parties, like Assembly and stuff, like 92 or The Party and things. And they would just chuck those chat logs as text files, and I would just scroll through them and just read them, like just hours of nonsense, like, you know, just pages of nonsense from a demo party, but just to try to learn and understand about different artists and musicians and what it was all about. So for me, it really was, yeah, very European, because the Australian scene was more about the cracking side of things. Rather than demos for a long time. I mean, there were some demos and things that came out, but I wasn't aware of that till much later.
Well, you ended up doing a kind of European demo scene tour at one point. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, it was a case of it was when I just sort of turned 18 or 19, that's when I discovered there was a demo scene in Australia, and I was super excited. And there wasn't a party locally in my city. So it was sort of the next city across, which is, Australia's big. So like 8-hour drive. And I didn't have a car at the time and I couldn't get there. And by the time I got a car and I'd saved up money and I was like, right, I can go and check this demo party out, it finished. And so I was like, oh. So I was like, well, maybe we start a demo party in Australia. And I was talking to my friend and we're like, yeah, okay, cool. Well, let's go overseas and let's just check what's happening in Europe first. So, we went over to Assembly Demo Party, just because that was, you know, the one from as a kid where all the classic stuff that I'd watched on the PC at first kind of like impressed me from. So I was like, well, we'll go to Assembly, we'll go to Evoke, we'll go to, there was another one. And we just went to these parties and just met these people. And yeah, suddenly, you know, here's your heroes, you know, just talking to you, and everyone's really cool and chilled out. And the guy who was running Evoke Demo Party, Triple X, was just, had me as a guest up when one of the compos, I think it was the Wild Compos, were on, and I was just sitting over looking the whole party, and he was just giving me beers and we were just chatting about parties. And he's like, yeah, just start a party and they will come. Like, don't question it or think if you're cool enough or whatever, just do it and make, you know, just put the word, find a place, time and place, and then put the word out. I just had so much good inspiration from that, and so many good people who in retrospect are absolutely, you know, right about that thing. And that really set a precedent for me for running events from that point on.
Is that where you got your name as well?
Yeah, well, that was Commodore Tricks from, I was Zor when I was a kid. Like, I had a totally different name, but I mean, there's so many people had that. It was like, oh, well, my handle's kind of like used. So I'd had that from Commodore Tricks, from something I'd done. I can't even remember where that came up, but I just shortened it to C-Tricks. And this was like, I think at about 99 or no, it might have been 98, kind of thing. So I'd done stuff long before that, but just sort of like under a different, I had a thing with my friend at high school that we were trying to program demos ourselves, but we weren't really able to do anything.
Well, you kind of came back to the Amiga and started making mods, but like in a more modern setting. Was that when you really started to get noticed by people in the European and general Amiga scene?
Yeah. I mean, there's a bit of a story behind that. I mean, when I was a kid, I did actually make mod files, like, this sort of like, this is from when I was like 12 or 13. You know, I had this sort of, rocky kind of stuff, you know.
Slack bass.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, totally. So that kind of thing, or this kind of like, that was when I was 11. So like I had these tracks from when I was a kid, and then I'd done the odd track that was a little bit more out there. Like I think when I was like 14, 15, I'd done this like, you know, because I'd started listening to rave music and stuff on the radio. So I was sort of right into it when I was...
You'll have to send me that one. It's good.
Yeah, that's like Utah Saints sort of inspired that. Like, I don't know. I just grabbed a bunch of stuff from all over the place and I'd mix up these, you know, really random tracks or these like, you know, that... You know, too much, too unlimited sort of... So that was like my vibe. But the thing was, just as I was getting into that as a kid and sort of, you know, experimenting with that stuff, I got into metal and I got into prog rock and fusion and jazz and I started playing in bands. So I kind of put the Amiga stuff on the wayside a little bit to make room for all of that stuff. And I was quite lucky. Like we were winning Battle of the Bands and like playing like for a kid, when you're a kid, like playing like, you know, at the mid-sized festivals and stuff. So, you know, I was balancing all of that as well as playing in orchestras and stuff with the schools thing. So there was sort of like the electronic stuff went on hold. And it was when I got into uni and everyone, there just wasn't a lot of people playing in bands, but there was a lot of DJs and people doing stuff. And I was like, I don't really want to DJ. I want to like play, you know, electronic music that I've written myself rather than DJ, because the DJ equipment was very expensive. So I bought myself a roll, this thing called a Groovebox, which for years like served me really well. It's this Roland sort of all in one production box and a sampler and doing techno-y sort of stuff. And that was super fun. So it was this kind of, oh, well, there we go. So the first thing I did was a remix of Commando. So I was actually like, this was from before I'd gone back to the Amiga stuff. I was still doing chip stuff, but you know, I was like,
Nice.
So that, for instance, just to let you put context, that's played in the middle of a forest, in the middle of winter, outdoors, in the middle of nowhere to about like 100 people, I guess, at a legal rave. So I was bringing this stuff like out there and like, you know, for fun, but it was very much in a remix sort of sense. It was just like, you know, just techno sort of... So, like, I had that vibe and that techno kind of thing that I was doing. And then one day, it would have been about 2005, I suppose, or four, I turned on my my box to work on something. And I can't remember what I was doing. I think what was in currently in memory, I was like, oh, yeah, I'll just save this before I work on something. And I had it sitting on my knees because it sort of was an all-in-one box. And I moved and the power cable fell out just as I hit save.
No.
And I turned it back on. It was wiped. It was completely gone. So I'd MIDI dumped it all out, backed it up, but I went to restore it and nothing came back. It didn't work. Now, at the time, I didn't know this, but the MIDI dump had actually worked. I was just sending it out back to the unit incorrectly, but I just thought at the time, and at least for another like year after that, I've just lost, you know, 5 years worth of work on this box and my backups haven't worked. Like, you know, I don't have any tunes. I've got a show, and I had a show 3 weeks later. So I was like, what am I going to do? How am I going to play? Because I don't even trust it. Maybe there's something wrong with the internal battery or something. I don't know if it's I'm going to lose all my tunes again. Like, what am I going to play off? What have I got that can make sound? And I had an Amiga that I'd got like a few years before that, that I'd had just kicking around, noodling around on for fun. And so I was like, well, maybe I'm just going to figure out a way to get all my old mods from the PC back across to the Amiga. Because at that point, I couldn't interface between the two. People forget it was quite hard to interface between a PC and an Amiga.
It was like a serial cable, wasn't it? And all this crazy, crazy software.
But I jumped in the deep end and bought a 1200 because I only had a 500. And that had a, which at the time was cheap, you know, $100 secondhand. So I just got one and that had the ability to read PC discs. And and then I just shoved all my old tracks on and I was like, I better make a few new tracks to go with these old ones. I wonder if I can still track. And I jumped back into a OpenMPT, which was a modern tracker. I think it was called ModPlug Tracker back then. And I remember I spent the first day tracking again and I just didn't go to bed. And it was like 5 a.m., 6 a.m., the sun started coming up. I was like, and then I literally just started canceling jobs, not going to uni, not doing, like, I just canceled everything and just spent 2 weeks tracking. And I wrote seven tracks. I wrote an entire set. And then I took my 500 and my 1200 to that show and I played this kind of live show that was, I guess, went down as, and people were just like, you got to keep playing that stuff. Whatever you just played is what you should be doing from now. And it was all of these like things that I'd worked on when I was a kid and half done. And then I'd sort of come back to them. So like lots of these, like, you know, so that old school kind of rave sound, and I was just went to town on it. And at the time, it was before that sort of was coming back, I guess. And, you know, and that party was just one of the wildest things I've ever done in my life. And that became, I guess, the moment where I was like, well, maybe I should rock parties with Amigas from now on.
Well, the first time me and Dan kind of heard of you was when we went on YouTube and Dan's like, check this video. There's a guy playing Amigas and everybody's going mental. It was like so awesome to see about 500 people in the club. It was one of your Horses remixes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, one of the early videos. That was just amazing to see. And you're right, that period kind of retro stuff wasn't massively big. And it was a bit of a kind of lost genre. No one was playing it anymore.
Well, and the thing is, what I really love about, and this is what I discovered as soon as I started tracking, is I've always loved that concept of getting a computer or getting anything and pushing it to its limit of what it can do. And I was doing that with my group box already, that like Roland box that I had, that and already pushing that to as far as I could. Like everyone else was buying all these additional add-ons and all these things and control layer. And I was like, no, I just want to do as much as I can with the one box. And I had that approach with the Amiga as well. And I guess having that 5-6 years in between of doing a lot of electronic music and understanding how electronic music worked a lot more, I came back to the Amiga knowing what I wanted to do, but I had to find out how to make those sounds and how to do things like combinations of kicks, snares, and drums and ducking around the audio to make things poke out. And so, like, you know, that changed my whole approach to tracking, and I got very technical with my tracking. And then the funny thing was I started tracking on Game Boy and Atari and Commodore and a bunch of others where I was using those same philosophies that I'd applied to the Amiga from doing electronic music before that. So I kind of reversed it in a way. A lot of people would track first and then they would move on to the, you know, the electronic live gear, whether it be samplers or, you know, performing with this in inverted commas professional gear, where I had the professional gear first and then like went to back to the Amiga. And it's just really fun because only having four channels as well, you've got to be very selective about what you use. And if you've got a rave pad, you know, that's front and center because that's 25% of your sound. You know, you put a drum in there and some hi-hats and you've only got one channel left to maybe do a crash or something. You don't have too much more space to work with. So you're always like thinking about what your parts are and trying to make them the best you can because you spend a lot, you'll spend an hour on a 5-second loop because you get that's going to be the crux of your track and it's only one of four elements that are people going to hear. So that concept of limitation is a beautiful thing.
And it always looks absolutely insane when you're tracking. Like for someone who's not techie, it looks like you're in the Matrix or something.
Yeah, it does. And to me, it just looks like you're in absolute noodle land when you've got like VSTs open all over the place and you're doing it. And I'm like, how the hell do you guys work like that when you can't just see everything that's happening within like 5 centimeters of your screen? Like,
you kind of learn to read it like music, you know, just seeing the notes going and knowing what's happening. And,
yeah. Oh, yeah. And I know. And the new way of doing things is very like 3D. Like, they've got like windows hiding, people are bringing up windows and closing windows and doing things. And I was just like lost. How can you even know where something is? You know, so it's interesting, I guess. It makes you think a little differently.
Well, this kind of playing live has led to you touring worldwide. So you've gone to Mexico, New Zealand, Germany, Japan, the Netherlands, Australia, USA, and the UK. Out of those, which has been your kind of favorite gigs?
And Hungary as well. And Italy.
And Hungary.
Wow. In Finland. Look, I don't think there is a favorite show as such because they're all very different. You know, everything you play, sometimes the smallest shows are the funnest. Sometimes the larger shows are, you know, fun as well. Probably, I had a pretty fun show years ago in London. It would have been about 6 years ago, somewhere in Hackney. And that was just like a real bunker of a show. And it was just really fun, just slamming tracks and the lineup. Everyone was doing something new and showing their new tracks. And the audience just was ready for new tunes. And that was just fun. That was just like a real, I don't know, it would have been like 30 people, 40 people, but it was a great crowd. I played a show in Germany and I love the Germans because they were like, how long do you want to play for? I was like, I don't know, like, how long do you want me to play for? They're like, well, how long can you play for? I was like, well, if I played like a bunch of stuff together, it'd be like 3 hours. So, you know, and before I could finish the sentence, he's like, well, then you would play for 3 hours. And I'm like, yeah, all right. Like, really? He's like, yeah. I was like, okay. And I did. And I played this freaking epic show. And that folder of tracks has been, because it really made me sort out like an order. How do I go for 3 hours and go from synthwave right the way through to like hard drum and bass and like breakcore at the end? And how do I go on that journey? And now I just kind of pluck from that master list plus add my new tracks in to like, you know, order a set. It's like, okay, so which area of this set am I going from? But it was like insane to sit and play this show that was 3 hours and just slam through. I was almost like in a trance, you know, and after, because it takes you like 20 minutes to warm up and get into the vibe of a show sometimes.
Yeah,
like,
for sure.
The stage and the sound and the nervous and energy out and the crowd to sort of like get in the vibe. And so when you've got that bit longer, because a lot of chip shows, when we talk about like the chip scene, there's this half an hour kind of thing that's, you know, a standard set. And I find that's like, you know, you can really get into it when it's like an hour. And when it's 3 hours, it was just like, wow, this is crazy.
I was going to say, like, you're really good at getting into your sets and when you're performing, kind of having a hyper energetic kind of performance, being really into the sound. And I find that incredibly hard. I just like look at my Amiga and get stuck in there, you know, ignore the whole audience and stuff. How do you get into that kind of mindset?
Well, a big thing for me is having like external surfaces to work with. So, I mean, I usually try to make it so I've got easy mute buttons for like my kicks and snares and stuff, which I'm just out of ProTracker. It's just Alt and whatever, ZXCV, I think it is, to mute those four channels. And then I always have filters, kind of reverbs and things. So there's a sort of performance that goes with the track of where things go in and where, like, you know, bass cuts in and out and does things. I sort of know how they would play out in a live sense. And I just sort of make sure that I'm always doing something, but it's just enough that I can have a good time. And if I miss something, it's not the end of the world. So making it so it's easy and fun, but so that, I don't know, you could still just rock out and the crowd are into it because they can see you're busy and doing stuff, but you can still rock with the crowd if you want and not have to stress about if you miss something, like it's just going to loop for a bit longer or whatever. So, and I don't know, it just, I just always like bopped along to my music.
A few more knobs then, I think, and stuff to twiddle with.
Yeah, and I always just have it like, yeah, on an analog desk or the DJM 800, which is a standard mixing desk for me, is great. It's got filters on it, so you can just and just kick in. You get kind of good at hitting the button just before it kicks in and doing things like, as you're doing build-ups, like you turn the volumes ever so slightly down to 9 instead of 10, and then you squelch it, and when it kicks back in, you just flick them both up to 10 again, and it just like...
Oh, nice.
It's the hard one.
Tips here.
So there's lots of things like that are just engineering. You're just engineering your set live, but as if the crowd are into it too and you're into it and everyone's having a good time, you know, that's the ultimate, really.
So you went to Blip Festival, and, you know, globally there was quite a few chiptune events going on, and yeah. even before COVID they seem to have kind of slowed down a bit.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that they're still there. Just the big grandiose ones that get publicized more have just probably settled down a bit. And that's just because it's quite hard and expensive, and, you know, it's a mission to put shows on. And it was the generation who were doing that was starting to get a bit older, I guess. And it wasn't, I guess, underground kind of electronic music had started to become a little bit more sort of known and things. And I don't think anyone who's ever run one of these festivals has ever done it without, it gets to a certain size where it's quite stressful to run because your costs of getting artists over and the rest of it is just like, you know, it's quite expensive and it's quite a lot of stress. And you're never going to get a massive amount of people. You're going to get a big crew of people. But if you look at the number of people you've got overseas and you've got people traveling in and stuff compared to like a big festival, you might have, you know, still eight artists, you know, coming and visiting, as does a big festival, but they've got 20,000 people, you've got 1,000, which is still amazing, but it's really hard to pay for everything and cover your costs. So there's just like, you know, like just people burn out and they just realize the formula worked better when you kept it to smaller sort of fun shows. And we've got one.
Yeah, Magfest seems to be the huge one at the moment.
Yeah, and that's backed off the back of Magfest. So obviously they have entertainment, and it's just a combination that works pretty well to have, you know, chip music artists on, you know, on that Saturday night, which I've played, and it's a really fun show, but it's very different to a chip music show. Like, it's sort of more everyone's just there to have a party, which is a great vibe, don't get me wrong. But it's like, you know, it's not the same as having, you still get all your friends on the front rows and stuff who are there like just like knowing what you're doing. But there's a bunch of people who just there to dance and jump around and be silly in their cosplay as well. It's a different vibe, but the best vibe. It's just totally, it's not the same as having a nice group of 40 people where people are heckling like between tracks and you can talk between tracks and it's fun. And, you know, it's a very different vibe. It's more of a punk vibe, I guess, when you're, it's like electro punk, it's like punk artists but retro. Imagine a crowd full of retro nerds yelling and joking around, and people like just yelling out for, you know, tracks that they know you're not going to play and things like, you know.
Well, you don't just make C64, Amiga and PC tunes as well. You use like many different systems. I even saw you doing stuff with the Vectrex recently.
Yeah,
what's the kind of most fun system to work with?
Oh, look, the Amiga's fun, but that's really a digital sampler. Probably the most opportunity and the craziest in terms of what you can do. The Commodore 64 is still amazing because it's got filters and the Rezo stuff, and but there's so many people who are amazing at using it, and it's, you almost have to be full time. but the Mega Drive is been pretty fun. Yeah, so I mean, I've been doing stuff like FM sort of based stuff, housey stuff. We'll never tire of, so in the case of that, that also has full vocal tracks running through it, through the sample track.
And wow.
So, and it's like, I was like, well, I got 4 meg worth of memory on a cart that I can use. I may as well fill it with full vocals and things like that. Yeah. So like the Sega is really fun, or the Sega Mega Drive, Sega Saturns. Oh, sorry, Sega Mega Drive. Sega Genesis is what I'm thinking of. With the FM stuff, I guess you've just got a really nice set of sounds to work with, you know, and it's great for electronic. And, you know, you can really cut through a sound system on it. The kick drum's really chunky. The hi-hats are really sharp and tight. So, yeah, FM is kind of like, a lot of people are moving on to it at the moment from the old simplicity of the Game Boy and things like that. But see, the Game Boy is great because it's portable and you turn the power on and within 2 seconds, it actually, less, a second, it's back where you left it and you just keep writing music. And it's like portable and it's in your hands and you've got a full piece of software that just runs on the Game Boy. So how do you compare that to running for the Mega Drive where you've got to have like, you know, a fairly complicated setup? It's a very different, it's like different systems for different situations. You can't sit on a bus and work on a Mega Drive track.
Well, also you've kind of built a crazy piece of hardware, the Guitari, which seemed to get a lot of press attention as well. Could you tell us more about that?
Well, yeah, but it's funny. I can, but it's not really much more than the Atari 2600 with an audio output. So basically, I wanted to do some stuff on the Atari because no one else was really doing it at the time much. And I was like, oh, what's the limit? Why is no one doing stuff on the Atari? And I was like, okay, well, there's no real software. So I had to write a tool that sort of like took, I made it so that it took my tracker output and then converted that into assembly code. So it kind of cross-compiled a special tracker file back into code that would then run. But I discovered after about 20 seconds of playing back music, because I had to play it quick enough to be able to do things like kick drums and like, because with a kick drum, you'd go really quick. If you speed it up quick enough, it becomes a kick drum. So you need to do stuff really quick and flip stuff around really quick to make the sounds that sound more modern. So by the time I did sped everything up, I just run out of memory instantly. So it was more of a coding exercise than anything, just to try to make some tracks on the Atari 2600. And I'd got this tracks going, and I was like, well, I really want to play it at, because I was playing at Blip Festival in New York, and I was like, I really want to play it. If I've just got the Atari, like for starters, the level output was really high. So I was like, I can't really just feed that into a desk. I need to sort of drop it down. So I ended up with a slap bass EQ pedal from Boss. It's like this pedal that's used to taking super high pickup from a big bass guitar, slap bass guitar, and dropping the level. So I had that as my drop pedal. And I was like, well, I really want something else to be able to hold notes if I'm doing stuff between tracks. So I added a delay pedal as well. I had this table full of crap, and I was like, well, this is going to take me forever to set up. I need to mount it all to a board. So I literally was just going to chuck it all on a piece of wood. And then I was like, well, I may as well just flip it upside down and wear it. And I was having a few beers with a mate, and I was like, do you reckon this would work? And he's just like, that's the funniest thing I've ever seen. You should totally make that. And we just literally went down Bunnings, which is our equivalent of whatever you have, Home Depot or whatever. And we just bought wood and Velcro and stuff, and then just started drinking beers and built the Qatari. And it was just the funniest thing we'd ever seen. We're like, this is so dumb.
And so that it does look truly awesome.
But it's not really. I mean, it's really just a replayer. And I have got a couple of routines where it'll loop, and there's a couple of breakpoints where I can jump out of the loop and continue the song. But apart from that, I mean, that's all I had memory for before, I couldn't do anything more. So,
and I'm loving that idea of kind of expanding your system with guitar pedals and different effects units and stuff like that. That's a really kind of smart way to add
extras. Variation. Yeah, because the problem was I was ending up with something that was just looping for, 30 seconds. It was like, well, how do I add some variation to loop? And if you just add delay, it's not so fun. But I was like, I want to just like do like, and this old delay pedal that I've had since I was a kid, I used to play guitar, and it's like you put it in the hold pattern, and then you turn the delay knob and it just goes, you're not supposed to do it. It's an artifact of the pedal. But it just sounds really good. And guitarists have done it for years, just chuck a big squelchy delay and like turn the knob down. So I just was doing that through the track to add some interest, to add some variation. It's very much a need, but I've got the tracks that I've done on that, if you hear how chunky they are, they just sound massive.
This is a new one, but...
And I guess they're more experimental as well.
Yeah. And it just turns out that it's really banging. Like, you get this through a big sound system. And especially with the sound engineer, and they just, like, they love it. And you tell them at front, look, I'm not going to send anything that's, like, too harsh. Just crank it. Like, crank the bait. Let it go as hard as you can. And they're like, all right.
give them free rein and they go mad. Yeah,
yeah, and especially in Japan, the one that went online, the sound of that show was just insane. It was just, the whole room was just shaking. It was this bunker of a club, and the whole place was just, they really went to town on it. So, but yeah, so that was the Qatari, and I mean, it was really just for fun. But I put together a little video for it because it was just, it seemed like a fun thing, and 1,000 people watched it, a couple of thousand people watched it. And then I don't know what happened. Hackaday or someone got hold of it, and someone else as well. And then suddenly it was like everyone was like together. It was like, oh, check. And then Matrix Synth and a bunch of others. And then suddenly the next day I woke up and there was 100,000 views. I'm like, oh, God, what happened?
So, well, talking of videos as well, you've started doing stuff for Debug Live as well. And
yeah,
it's absolutely fantastic. You're budget dance music video. That's on like nearly 500,000 views now.
Probably, yeah. Thank you. Yeah, that was me telling the story of the Amiga. And I really wanted to put down my experience of a kid of sampling, you know, because, I mean, I'd have my friend's Amiga and I had my PC as well that I would sample from. And it was that thing of the adding the stuff that you didn't have and listening to the radio, like I was explaining earlier, late at night where you would hear stuff and you'd have a cassette always ready and you'd be trying to just get those moments that were a rave pad or a bass note or a drum beat or something like that so that you could have that in your repertoire of sounds. Especially when you didn't have access to, you know, professional libraries and things as a, you know, 12-year-old. So I just wanted to put that story down and tell it from the perspective of just having a simple sampler. And that's all you had, you know, and maybe some records that, you know, you'd got from a cheap $1 store or some old tapes and, yeah. And that B-side thing of finding, you know, on the flip side of a 12-inch or a 7-inch that you had an instrumental one that had all of these elements you could, you know, take out. So, yeah, I just wanted to tell that story. And, yeah, and I did spend a bit of time collecting, like making sure I had like a proper of-the-generation amp and setup and turntable, and everything had to be legit for that video. So I went to a lot of effort to try to make it as much of that story as humanly possible, you know, of the day. And, yeah, people really responded to it. And I think they sort of went, well, no, this is how you could make music if you just had an Amiga, you know, as a kid.
And you've also done like commercial music releases. A is for Amiga was one of your releases. Could you tell us more about those?
Commercial music release. I'd just say that was just fun. Like, yeah, well, Ava Amiga was just me noodling around with my childhood samples. And I guess a lot of those early, there was some sample tracker samples right at the start of the Amiga's days. It kind of became the standards for sounds. And even as a kid, you know, without access to much software, like I could still get hold of a bunch of those samples. So I just wanted to make something using a lot of those older samples. And there's a couple of tracks on it that do use like my modern samples as well, like from my DX7 and things like I sampled in. But it was very much that 1980s vibe. And I recorded it all out to 2-inch tape. So this like really analog giant old format from the, you know, end of the 70s, and we mixed it all without a computer. So we mixed the whole thing just from tape, just using our ears. Yeah, and it was kind of like that process of mixing something, but, you know, in a high quality studio I could have only dreamt of using as a kid, but using the Amiga again. And yeah, and it was just fun synth sort of tracks. Yeah, and then I guess one of the record company or what it was, a net label, wanted to put it out, and so yeah, they put that out. And yeah, so it became on Spotify and things like that. I've got like heaps more tunes. It's just, I don't know, it was just a lot of effort to get it sounding perfect. So I'm just like, I prefer it to be a bit more hack and then live at shows. But now I'm obviously with what's going on, I'm considering, well, maybe I need to sort of release some stuff. So,
well, what do you kind of have planned next? Have you been making any new tunes or are you going to be doing any live stream performances or anything?
I've done a bunch of live stream stuff and things. I'm kind of over it at the moment. I think I'm just going to take a break for a few months and then come. I've got to, unfortunately, just due to the whole COVID thing, I've got to kind of get kicked out of my studio. So I've got to rebuild a new studio. It's going to take a few months. So maybe at the end of that, once everything, like I'm joining up forces with a dude who's really cool. In fact, he wants to put A from Amiga out on vinyl. He was like pushing for that phase. He's like, oh, you know, I'll find it, blah, blah. So I'm moving in with really good people who already have a computer retro museum. So it's like, it's a good move, I think, but just reinventing your life takes a little bit of time sometimes. So in between that time, I don't think I've got too much planned. I do have a DOS game that I'm working on with a bunch of guys called Dust Fury. And that's a whole load of ad-lib stuff. The Sound Blaster 16, we've got these like, they're kind of like, you know, sort of like techno, ad-lib techno, or Sound Blaster techno, super minimal, like, it's got all this like, yeah. And this sort of like opening title track. So that's that old FM, that ad-lib sound. So I'm working on the soundtrack for that at the moment, which is pretty cool.
That sounded lovely, to be fair.
Oh, yeah. So that's kind of like where we're sort of working towards that. But that's kind of tricky because it's, it's a Pentium era stuff, like Pentium 100, 150 era, like or Pentium 100 to 200 era game, all based around voxel graphics. If you remember the old voxel style games, I don't know if you ever played Terminal Velocity or any of those games.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so it's that same style of like, it's like a hard-coded 3D engine. So we're not using engines or anything. We're doing it all with assembler and C++. So it's like, yeah, it's pretty hectic. And then the music's all ad-lib and trying to get the replayers working and stuff not glitching. But we've got a PC and a Mac build of it that'll run natively and emulate everything as well. So it's kind of, it's kind of a modern old-school crossover. You can either play it on a Pentium 100 or play it on your new computer. So I guess that's a really nice hardcore project to be sort of working on to distract myself from, you know, the world at the moment.
Well, where can our listeners get hold of your stuff as well and just find out more information on you?
Well, you see, that's weird because I often just do live stuff. But look, I've got, I guess on, there's a SoundCloud that's really old because it ran out of room about 6 years ago and I haven't been bothered to put anything else back up. There's a torrent of my USB stick because I usually put all my stuff on a USB stick and just sell it at shows. And there is a torrent somewhere out there of that. I don't know where it is, but if you just like search for C-Tricks, I think somebody dumped it somewhere. Because it's all Creative Commons, you can do what you want with it. If you just scour the sort of scene.org for C-Tricks mod files and MP3 files, there's stuff out there. There is the A4 Amiga release, but honestly, I've been pretty slack in releasing stuff. There was a bunch of great live streams, and I was hoping to just be able to playlist all the live streams I've done in the last few months, and they've all just disappeared. They've all been taken down, or like Twitch, I didn't realize it timed out. So I built this cool list of like, hey, everyone, here's 7 hours worth of sets to listen to, and they've all gone. So I'm like, oh.
Awesome. Thanks so much for talking to us, C-Tricks. I really enjoyed this one.
No worries. Good to chat to you as well.
Buying a car in Carvana was so easy. I was able to finance it through them.
Whoa, wait, you mean finance?
Yeah, finance. Got pre-qualified for a Carvana auto loan, entered my terms, and shopped from thousands of great car options all within my budget.
That's cool that financing through Carvana was so easy.
Financed. Done. And I get to pick up my car from their Carvana vending machine tomorrow.
Financed.
Right, that's what I said.
You can spend time trying to pronounce financing, or you can actually finance and buy your car today on
Carvana.
Financing subject to credit approval. Additional terms and conditions may apply.